Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio, your intelligence briefing in the war for the free world. I'm your guest host for today, Kyle Scheidler. Joining me in our first segment is a man you know very well. He's the president of the Center for Security Policy and your host here at Secure Freedom Radio. He is Frank Gaffney. Frank, thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thank you so much for hosting. I'm absent in Colorado at the moment, and I appreciate very much you picking up the baton and running with it, Kyle. It's good to have you in the chair.
It's my pleasure. Frank, I want to talk to you a little bit about a threat that our listeners at Secure Freedom Radio know very well, which is the electromagnetic pulse threat. But this most recent problem with the EMP threat comes not from North Korea, not from Iran, but from the U.S. government and their effort to kill the EMP Commission. Can you talk to us about that?
Yeah, well, there's something in the Bible once or twice about how poorly treated prophets are. And I'm afraid that this is being borne out in the case of the Congressional Electromagnetic Pulse Threat Commission, which has been operating for about 17 years now, all of it under the leadership of, I think, most extraordinary public servant. I have had the privilege of working and being a colleague of Dr. William Graham back through all these years to the Reagan administration, where he served as the president's science advisor. And for all of those 17 years, get this, neither he nor his other panel members in this extraordinary blue ribbon group have taken a single paycheck from the government for their services, which have been extensive and often exasperating, I think, particularly of late. The commission has had as its charter trying to help the rest of us understand what is going on with respect to the vulnerabilities of our electric grid, the so-called bulk power distribution system, and the extent to which adversaries, whether they're North Korea at the moment or Russia in the past, China, Iran, who knows who all else, might do to essentially exploit those vulnerabilities and take down the grid, putting basically the entire United States in the kind of condition, only more so, that we're currently watching play out with horror in Puerto Rico. So this is a moment, Kyle, I think, when we need this commission more than ever. The danger, for crying out loud, we're having the North Korean dictator actually threaten to use electromagnetic pulse to destroy our grid and destroy our country. We need that that EMP commission and its expertise and its recommendations to be implemented more than ever in our history, I believe.
That doesn't seem to be on the radar, most especially of the folks at the Defense Department who are supposed to oversee the funding for this commission. They have very much expressed a desire to, if not impede, at least not assist the commission in their important work.
Well, I think not impede is closer to the mark by far. Indeed, the most recent round of this commission, it's had essentially three lives, starting in 2001, giving rise to a report in 2004. Then again, I think it gave another report in 2012, as I recall, maybe 2008 as well. But in any event, it's periodically provided updates and analyses that support the need to protect the grid. And the most recent of these lives was supposed to be for 2 years, starting about 2 years ago. And unfortunately, for the first excuse me, I think it was a year and a half long lifespan. For the first year, the commission was prevented from having the resources, the contractor support, the clearances, the access to information, and so on, that it needs to do its job. It was sabotaged, in other words, by basically the Obama administration. And now, amazingly, during the Trump administration, some of those same people, surprise, surprise, Obama holdovers, problem we talk about a lot on this program, have continued to see what they can do to prevent this commission from doing its important work, and especially to prevent the implementation of their long needed, long overdue action on their recommendations.
Frank, where do you think the resistance comes from? I know we talk a lot about, for example, the electrical grid industry's opposition to regulation on this issue, but where does the opposition come from within the government itself?
Well, look, I think, Kyle, it comes down to this. Life is just a lot easier for a lot of people, including people in the military, who would just as soon not have to spend money on electromagnetic pulse hardening for their weapon systems or for their command and control techniques or for their operations more generally. And if they can snuff people who are telling them, you need to pay attention to this, you need to take corrective action, it can save them money. It can save them, engineering wear and tear and other challenges that might threaten their careers. Whatever the reason is, it's not acceptable because, in point of fact, both our military is extraordinarily dependent upon the civilian grid, and so are the rest of us. In fact, 99% of the U.S. military's missions are here in the United States are supported by or require access to electricity from the electric grid of the civilian sector. So this is simply unconscionable. It is a scandal. And my hope is, Kyle, as I mentioned in our commentary today, that the president will step up and will take over the sponsorship of this commission, make it a presidential commission, and set about implementing at the earliest possible moment, which should be yesterday, the recommendations for how to go about protecting the grid and thereby avoiding the kind of peril that we're facing right now. And this is no exaggeration. The government itself has found this to be true in at least 11 studies done in the past decade or so. Truly avoiding a nation-ending threat. That's what's at stake here, and we can't afford to pretend otherwise any longer.
Well, I think you raise a really good point, Frank, and it's interesting how so many of our problems of late dealing with the Trump administration have been this holdover problem, this so-called deep state problem, where the desire by the bureaucracy to sort of go along, to get along, or to avoid making changes at a time when, unfortunately, because of mismanagement over the past 8 years, changes are desperately necessary.
Yeah. Well, as we've talked about on the program a lot, this is, I'm afraid now, increasingly, Donald Trump's responsibility. We can't really lay this off on Obama. If it happens that it's his personnel, yes, who are sabotaging Donald Trump and his policy, promises to the American people, if the president tolerates it, if he indulges it, if he allows it to persist, he has to be responsible for it. I'm hoping that he will make it clear that he won't have any longer truck with this from H.R. McMaster, from his National Security Council staff, or from others in the Defense Department or elsewhere. But it's certainly the case that as long as this continues, we're going to see the nation undefended against the EMP threat, particularly electromagnetic pulse, and a whole host of others as well, I'm afraid.
Well, I'm hopeful that President Trump will step up to the plate, take your recommendation of making the AMP Commission a presidential commission. Frank, thank you so much for raising this important issue with us here on Secure Freedom Radio. Coming up will be Matt Brodsky. He'll be talking to us about the Kurdistan referendum going on right now in Iraq. So stay tuned on Secure Freedom Radio.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio. This is your guest host for today, Kyle Scheindler from the Center for Security Policy. I'm filling in for Frank Gaffney. Joining me now is Matt Brodsky. He's a senior fellow at the Security Studies Group. He's also a senior analyst at Wikistrat and the former director of policy for the Jewish Policy Center for Security Policy. Matt, I wanted to talk to you today a little bit about the situation in Kurdistan. You've been writing about it quite a bit lately, and I wanted to get your perspective. Talk to me about what's going on there.
Well, you just had a referendum that took place in the Kurdish region. A lot of that was brought on by internal political dynamics, with Barzani scheduled to leave in November. And he wanted to launch the process, knowing that the process of independence, knowing that, any assurance that he had been given by the central government has proven to be a failure. And, you know, the Kurds admit that after 2003, after the U.S.-led invasion in Iraq, they regret very much deciding to come back and join in and to stay within the country. So basically, any assurances and promises they were given, whether it's from the central government, whether it's from international community, even the United States, has all failed. So you can understand from their perspective why they're trying to reset where negotiations would begin. And that's important for them to have done. And clearly, if you're them, it makes a lot of sense.
It does make sense. Matt, the U.S. government came down against the referendum, joining the Turks, the Iranians, and of course, the Iraqi central government. Now, this, for a lot of us that have been studying Kurdistan for a while, felt like a bit of a betrayal. Can you talk about U.S. policy as it relates to the Kurds, where we're going and why?
The Trump administration really hasn't, they came into office with two essential goals in the Mideast: to destroy ISIS and to push back on Iran. They haven't pushed back on Iran, and that is something that has just been left up to the nuclear issue, which they're still deciding on in October. When it comes to pushing back on ISIS, that is the only goal. They have not taken into account the web of interests in the Middle East at all. There's no plan for Syria from the Trump administration that I can see that handles any of the competing interests. So what the Trump administration really has done is taken the Obama administration plan and thus far put it on steroids. So the Obama administration reached out to the YPG in Syria and the Kurds there and wanted to work with them to create a force, albeit reluctantly and way too late. And the United and so Trump is basically just expanded that role. Now, he has no plan really for after it, and that's why Assad has been making overtures to the Syrian Kurds, because Assad is smart enough to realize that the U.S. is giving him a gift by leaving Russia and Iran essentially in charge of Assad and all of Syria. The Kurds understand, and Assad understands, that he can negotiate with the Kurds after the United States leaves, and the Kurds know that they are capable themselves of cutting a deal with Assad. So what Assad isn't able to take over by using what's left of his armed forces to fight ISIS, what he can't take over in the Kurdish region, he assumes that he'll just be able to negotiate. And really, there's not a reason to doubt that that's going to happen. That should be a problem from the United States perspective. You know, the U.S. hasn't figured out what it really wants to do with Turkey. That's a major question. There are ways that the U.S. could have prosecuted the war, working more with Turkey if they wanted to, as bad as Erdogan's behavior has been. But really, this is just an expansion of a previous policy, and it doesn't seem to take into account the step after. And, you know, what comes tomorrow is obviously important because there's nothing longer in the Middle East than memory.
I think that's a really good point. And, you know, you raised the issue of the focus on defeating ISIS. And one of the ways we chose to do that, as you mentioned, was backing Kurdish groups both in Syria and in Iraq, while at the same time, on the Iraqi side of the border, we still insisted on this policy of making the Iraqi central government the primary driver of policy. That's a problem when the Iraqi central government relies very closely on its relationship with Iran and Shia militias led by a designated terrorist. Are we in a situation where we're trying to have our cake and eat it too, instead of simply backing a horse and backing them to the hilt, if I can mix my metaphors?
Absolutely correct. And I've been arguing this since 2011, that it's better for the United States to have a horse inside the race, so to speak, when it came to Syria, no matter what policy that the United States is going to decide on. The central government in Iraq is increasingly beholden to Iran, and obviously that's what we should be pushing back against. But there, you know, why would the Kurds think to themselves that the central government is going to come through for them if the Sunnis in the Anbar province and in western Iraq don't trust the central government? You know, and there's no reason for the Kurds to believe that. And for the United States, they need to be thinking, okay, if the perspective is that Erdogan is irredeemable, he's essentially growing into an autocrat, or increasingly more an autocrat, patterning rule over the Muslim Brotherhood template, then wouldn't it be better then to replace Turkey as an ally, or to at least gain leverage? You know, to gain that leverage, you need more than just to temporarily work with Kurds in Syria. If these are our people who, throughout two major failed states, Syria and Iraq, then we should be working with them, because that would be our proverbial horse. And at the same time, we are still wedded to the idea of a unified, independent Syria and Iraq. It doesn't make a whole lot of sense. And a lot of this policy is being articulated by Brett McGurk, a holdover from the Obama administration, and someone who was also very much someone who really helped instrumentally put together the Iran deal and to sell it. So, you know, there's a lot of reasons for Americans to be concerned.
A very good point, Matt. Real quickly, Iraq is threatening to take away Kurdish autonomy at their border stations and at their airports, and moving military forces as well. Not much time, but is there a possibility of a Kurdish-Iraqi conflict somewhere in the short term?
I don't actually think in the short term, you know, but you have to understand, the Sunnis together can't coalesce, you know, to agree that it's the sun that rises in the morning, unfortunately. When you look at, just take Turkey, for example, of course, a Kurdish region in Iraq relies on Turkey for oil exports. Okay, but look at Turkey has been working with ISIS to export their oil while claiming that they wanted to fight them. When it comes to money, autocrats will do what they can to make money, and I think a lot of it is bluster. If it was really that important, they would have made a really compelling case not to hold a referendum to begin with, and a while ago.
Good point. Matt, thank you so much for joining us here on Secure Freedom Radio. We will be back shortly.
Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio. I'm your guest host, Kyle Scheidler, filling in for Frank Gaffney, who is off today. Joining me now is the director of Jihad Watch and weekly columnist for PJ Media and Front Page Magazine. He's a good friend of Secure Freedom Radio, Robert Spencer. Robert, thanks for joining us today.
Great to be here, Kyle. Thank you.
I want to talk to you a little bit about something that is near and dear to us here on Secure Freedom Radio, and that's free speech. I know you're a strong advocate for free speech, particularly in the conflict with Islamic supremacism and Islamic blasphemy laws that we're seeing really being pushed now in all manner of international forum, and most especially in Europe. And you've been working very hard to draw people's attention to this. And I was hoping you could talk to me a little bit about your recent film, Can't We Talk About This? The Islamic Jihad Against Free Speech. Well, Robert, can we talk about it?
No, actually not. And the fact is that that's a quote, Kyle, from Theo van Gogh, the Dutch filmmaker who was murdered on the street in the middle of the day in Amsterdam in 2004 for the crime of criticizing the plight of Muslim women under Islamic law. And he was, of course, murdered by an Islamic jihadi who stabbed a knife into his body with a note explaining why he had done it and adding a hit list of future targets. The incident was emblematic of what's going on in the West, all over the Western world nowadays, and that is that in the face of violent threats and intimidation, we are being silenced, and the West is willingly adopting, essentially, what are Sharia blasphemy laws that forbid criticism of Islam in the face of this violent bullying. You know, back in fifth grade, we learned that the best way to deal with a bully was to stand up to him, but now the whole world seems to have forgotten that, and everyone is giving in to the bully. So that, for example, of course, in 2015, Pamela Geller and I did an event in Texas of drawing Muhammad that was designed not simply to gratuitously insult anyone or offend their religious sensibilities, but to stand up for the freedom of speech in the face of the fact that in January 2015, the Islamic jihadis in Paris murdered the Charlie Hebdo cartoonist for the crime of drawing Muhammad. When people tell you they're going to kill you for drawing Muhammad, you either have to draw Muhammad or you have to surrender. But there really isn't any other choice. You can ignore the fact that the choice has been presented, but ultimately you're going to have to come down on one side or the other. So we were showing we were not going to give in to violent intimidation and we're going to stand. Of course, that event was attacked by Islamic jihadis. And in the wake of it, what I think was most jarring is that Geller was criticized by people on the left and the right who have all internalized the idea since the killing of Van Gogh and so many other incidents. They've internalized the notion that you just don't criticize Islam. You don't offend Muslims in regard to Muhammad. And this is Sharia. This is Islamic law. This is not a society that values the freedom of speech and the principle, I may object to what you say, but I will defend to the death your right to say it. Free speech is the foundation of a free society. And in this film, we show that it's being rapidly eroded in the face of an organized Islamic effort to impose these Sharia blasphemy restrictions upon the West.
You know, Robert, I think you make a really good point when you raise the issue of how people treated Pamela following that event in Garland. Of course, there's sort of a dichotomy there because on the one hand, we saw that violent jihadis who try to take away our speech, we have a way of dealing with them. But the sort of media and talking heads who jump into these situations and say, no, just shut up and everything will be fine, they're actually more difficult to deal with. And even more difficult still is the law enforcement and the government officials who, after these incidents, move in to crack down against people, for example, complaining about the Manchester bombing in England, making arrests for what people say on Twitter. Those bullies are actually harder to deal with.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely. And that's a concerted effort. Just this morning at Jihad Watch, my website, which is, of course, a news and commentary site tracking jihad activity, I put up a story from the Daily Mail, the UK paper, explaining how a group of Muslims on the street and outside a church in London started to play very loud recordings of explosions while screaming Allahu Akbar. And it was interesting to note that somebody said, this is sort of commonplace nowadays in East London, which is, of course, a largely Muslim area. And the Met Police was not aware of the incident. And I think the Met Police has announced that they're going to crack down hard on what they call online hate speech and Islamophobia. But here's somebody directly engaging in terrorist intimidation, and they don't even know what's going on. And the Daily Mail, very tellingly also, has had an announcement at the end of the article. Comments are being moderated in advance on this article. In other words, they don't want people start to talk about Islam and Muslims and the larger problem that this incident embodies. They wanted to keep a very tight lid on what was said about this incident and what its implications are. And this is a pattern all over the West that we're censoring ourselves, and there's increasing censorship from authorities preventing honest discussion of the nature and magnitude of the jihad threat.
And I think the nature and magnitude of that threat is in part really why the law enforcement turns against, you know, their own population, who are frankly law-abiding and therefore easier to deal with. And the notion being cracking down on jihadis among the population is difficult. Cracking down against grandmothers and cartoonists is relatively easy. And so why not focus on the easy problem rather than deal with the messy problem?
Yeah, that's a very good point. But of course, it's ultimately suicidal, because if they're going to continue to crack down on people who are calling attention to the threat or venting their frustration over the authorities' supine reaction to the threat, then the threat itself is going to continue to advance, and it's only going to get worse. And these are people who have vowed to conquer. And so do British authorities really think if they forbid people from talking about this and are tougher against people who do talk about it than against people who actually act upon the threat itself, that it's going to go away? Well, they're going to be rudely surprised.
And of course, the only real solution here is to talk about it. These issues have to be raised so that there are forums where people can discuss these issues. But there's a strong effort, both in Europe and here in the United States, to so-called deplatform people. We saw an effort, for example, with the Southern Poverty Law Center, where they have used that hate list as an excuse to remove people from their internet providers. Have you guys faced anything like that at Jihad Watch so far?
Very much so, Kyle. Just yesterday, I got notice. Somebody wrote me saying, I could not put your material up at Pinterest. Now, I don't know anything about Pinterest. I know it's some sort of a photo site. So photos not being the main focus of my work, I've never really paid any attention to it. But apparently people were taking some of the material that I put up at Jihad Watch and posting it at Pinterest until yesterday, when they got notice that they were not allowed to do this because it was hate speech. And this follows, of course, PayPal banning Jihad Watch for a brief period until an outcry made them restore it. Meanwhile, Facebook and Twitter have used various algorithms to choke off 90% of the referrals from each to Jihad Watch. And it's all based on the Southern Poverty Law Center's false claim that we are engaging in hate. The catch is that everyone who speaks about the jihad threat in any honest manner is accused of hate speech by this organization, which, of course, has refused to add Antifa or any leftist hate group to its list. It has come under a good deal of quite justified criticism for trying to smear honest conservative groups that are perfectly legitimate, are not advocating violence or hatred, but are merely calling attention to genuine threats that are outside the leftist agenda, and trying to defame them and marginalize and destroy them by lumping them in with real hate groups like the Klan and neo-Nazis and so on.
Well, Robert, we certainly appreciate what you're doing on the front line of this battle. And make no mistake, folks, free speech is ultimately the front line of this battle, this counter-jihad, because without free speech, we cannot deal with the rest of these problems. Robert, thank you so much for joining us. Coming up next, we'll be joined by Fred Flights of the Center for Security Policy. Stay tuned, just a moment.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio. I'm your guest host, Kyle Scheidler, filling in today for Frank Gaffney. Joining me now, my good friend and colleague at the Center for Security Policy. He's a senior VP for policy and programs at the center. He's also a former analyst at the CIA and the former chief of staff for Ambassador John Bolton at the U.S. State Department. He is, you know him well, Fred Flights. Fred, thank you for joining us.
Hey, Kyle. Good to be here.
Fred, I want to talk to you about a concept that recently popped up in the news, and that is something that you're calling clean decertification of the Iran deal. There's a lot of plans and articles swirling around the Beltway in the last couple weeks about the Iran deal and how to deal with it, and what you're talking about is unfortunately not the leading menu option right now, but it ought to be. Tell us what it means to do a clean decertification.
Well, Ambassador John Bolton has come up with a plan to get the United States out of this terrible nuclear deal with Iran, which President Obama correctly called an embarrassment to the United States and the worst deal ever negotiated. And Bolton's argument is that, well, the president's right. This deal helps Iran actually get closer to a nuclear weapon, and it's weak verification. Iran's behavior has gotten worse under it. It doesn't include Iran's missile program. Let's stop playing games, get out of this terrible agreement, and put together another arrangement that addresses all the threats from Iran and permanently bars transfers of nuclear technology to Iran. There's this extremely dishonest argument being advanced by the other side, and I think it's being advanced principally by National Security Advisor H.R. McMaster and his followers, that, okay, the president wants to not certify the agreement by an October 15th deadline to Congress. Okay, he cannot certify. But we'll still stay in the deal to fix it later. Kyle, that's not going to happen. This is just a recipe to making sure we never withdraw from the deal. We need a clean withdrawal. We need Bolton's plan.
Well, I think I'm inclined to agree with that. Fred, talk to me a little bit about your most recent piece at Fox News talking about a clean withdrawal. How do we move forward to accomplish this?
Well, Fox News Opinion was nice enough to run an article that I published today on this piece, and John Bolton will soon have another one in the Wall Street Journal. And what Mr. Bolton is proposing is that we first consult very closely with our top allies. And I just don't mean Europe. I also mean the Saudis and the Israelis. The current nuclear deal with Iran excluded Israel. We didn't even talk to them to get their input for this agreement, even though Iran is a much bigger threat to them than it is to us. We tell them we're going to do this. We try to get their buy-in. I think Israel will be very valuable in pushing this plan. Then there will be a white paper with a comprehensive strategy on how to go forward and the case for why the nuclear deal with Iran, the JCPOA, is a fraud. There then will be a fairly massive diplomatic and public relations campaign to push why this deal is bad and why we have to move forward. And frankly, I think when President Trump and other Trump officials talk about the outrageous concessions in the nuclear deal, the American people will be behind the president. There then has to be a new series of sanctions, not just on nuclear technology transfers, but also on sponsorship of terrorism, on providing technology for missiles to Iran. And these sanctions have to be in place permanently. Under the Iran deal, the sanctions have all been lifted, and there'll be almost no restrictions on Iran's uranium enrichment program in less than 8 years. That's unacceptable.
You know, one of the things I don't understand, and you've raised it here a little bit, is that Iran deal defenders have said, well, you know, we can work on Iran, sanctions for Iran related to terror or related to human rights. Just don't touch the deal. Please don't touch the deal. And I've never understood the logic of that. How can they argue with a straight face that we can comprehensively deal with the threat posed by Iran, yet keep this deal in place?
Well, the way I see it, there's two arguments. First of all, these people who don't want the deal to go away, and they're good people, they're people who are conservatives, not many of them, they're arguing, look, the Europeans are with this deal, we can't leave alone. And that's the position of H.R. McMaster. I'm sorry, Europe doesn't have a veto over our foreign policy. Europe didn't veto us getting out of the Paris Climate Change Agreement. That's not a valid argument. And also, if you read Jay Solomon's book on the nuclear deal, you'll read about how John Kerry and his team ridiculed and twisted the arms of the French delegation to get them to drop their objections to the concessions Kerry was making to get this deal. The French shouldn't have went along with this, and I think we should remind them of that. There's also an argument that, well, this is an international agreement, and we just can't back out of it because it's international. There's other parties to it. That's also a fake argument. This is really an agreement between the U.S. and Iran. Everything done by the Obama administration to prop this up were additional concessions only by the U.S. The other nations were just around along for the ride. This was just advanced by the Obama administration to make it harder to argue that the next president can't back out of it. It's not a treaty. Trump can kill it at any time.
Well, that's why I think Bolton's plan to speak with our allies makes so much sense. As you said, you know, being able to go back to the French and say, look, you guys never really wanted this. Let's start over again. Let's come up with something that is actually workable. Is there room to move the Europeans? The Iran deal defenders say the Europeans, you know, would choose Iran over us, essentially, if they're forced to choose. Is that really true?
I don't think so. I think if we put sanctions on any company that provides nuclear technology, and there's large ones in Europe, well, they're going to have to choose. Are they going to sell this stuff to the world's leading state sponsor of terror and lose all their business in the United States, or are they going to stop selling this stuff to Iran? I think it's an easy call. And look, we're the leader of the free world. We have to put our foot down on issues like this. The world's not used to that. After 8 years of appeasement by Barack Obama, having John Kerry being rolled over by the Iranian foreign minister, we have to assert ourselves and make it clear we're the leader of the free world. The last president had given up a lot of the legitimacy and credibility that America had, and America's back, and we're getting rid of this terrible agreement.
So what about the argument that if we do this, the Iranians are going to somehow act up on the international stage? Is that a legitimate argument? How do we handle their response to us getting out of the deal?
Yeah, I've heard that argument, that Iran will start acting badly. And Iran's recent missile tests have threatened to test missiles are in reaction to Trump's threat to kill the deal. But wait. Iran stepped up its missile test during the Obama administration. It sent troops into Syria right after the nuclear deal was announced. This is an argument that if we back out of the deal, Iran will act worse. And Kyle, that's not a legitimate argument. That's an argument to get out of this terrible agreement. I mean, basically, we have encouraged them to think they can become a regional hegemon, that they can engage in destabilizing belligerent behavior with no consequences. It's time to stop this.
Well, Fred, I appreciate your clear-headed explanation as to what exactly is going on in this Beltway fight over the Iran deal. You're a huge asset to us here on Secure Freedom Radio, helping lay out how all of this works, and we really appreciate it. So thank you very much. All right, folks, that does it for us today here on Secure Freedom Radio. I have been your host, Kyle Scheidler. Frank will be back at the microphone tomorrow at the same time, same place, same channel. Thank you so much, and good night.
The nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.